Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you. Hopefully you all had an enjoyable lunch and appreciate you all coming back. The room looks nearly as full as it did earlier this morning, which is good. I'd now like to introduce Mike Cairns-Terry, Principal Engineer for Progressive Energy. So over to you, Mike.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So you heard from Chris this morning about HyNet. So I'll be focusing this afternoon particularly on our interactions with potential users of hydrogen. So I think you're probably familiar with Progressive Energy by now. Been working to develop low carbon energy projects since 1998, really trying to focus where we can make a material difference to climate change, hence attempting projects on the scale of HyNet. And I think the message has come across pretty clearly already about the collaboration that's been necessary to deliver this and the broad alliance of companies working on it. And you'll have seen something very similar from Chris about the different elements of HyNet. As I said, I'll be focusing on the users. So as we talk to users about switching to hydrogen, they're only interested if there's clean hydrogen available. So we have some activities in that space. So our first large-scale production will be CCS-enabled hydrogen. So that's the 350-megawatt HPP1 plant. So Keir Starmer was up there announcing funding back in October, which was an exciting day for us. We've got the EPC contract signed for that. Looking towards getting that one going, and then following it with a 1,000-megawatt HPP2 shortly after, which will give us material quantities of hydrogen, enough for Liverpool, at least. And alongside that, we're looking at electrolytic production, so we've got an 11-megawatt electrolytic project that we've bid into HAR2, which will be for deployment at Pilkington's Greengate furnace, which I'll talk a bit more about later, because that's one of the success stories from our fuel switching program. So when we've looked towards identifying users and deploying hydrogen, we've really taken the view that it's easier to convert a small number of large-scale users than a very large number of small-scale or domestic users. So we tended to focus on industrial users and power generation as well. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the considerations that users have when we come to talk to them about hydrogen. So one of the first things they're concerned about, particularly direct fired processes, is their product quality. Are their consumers going to see any change in the product that they're getting? They're concerned about regulatory compliance. Is this going to do anything to our ability to comply with our emission limits values, for example? Safety, are we going to be keeping our people safe when we use hydrogen? Is it going to damage our equipment? And then the commercial considerations around conversion costs of the equipment, security of supply, particularly in the early years of hydrogen network deployment. It won't be as robust as natural gas. So I think about, okay, well, how can we make sure that if hydrogen isn't available, we can still operate? And all of those questions are questions that we sought to answer with the IFS program, so the industrial fuel switching program. Then there are further commercial questions about low carbon. Again, as I said, it's only worth doing if it's going to be saving carbon. The low carbon hydrogen standard from the government has been really helpful on that score, giving us something to point to say, to give a robust defense. And what's it going to do to our operating costs? So firstly, from a fuel cost perspective, again, the government, the low carbon hydrogen agreement is really helpful there, providing hydrogen at equivalent cost to natural gas. And then there's the efficiency aspect, which again, we're looking to address through this fuel switching program. So the technical feasibility questions, we assess them all at a feasibility stage. And then we designed follow-on demonstrations of hydrogen use to address any specific concerns that were raised during feasibility work, to validate the conclusions, to gather real operational data, and also to develop commercial operating methodologies. So the industrial fuel switching work that we've done has been funded by the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy and its successor, DESNES. So the first program that we were involved with ran between 2019 and 2022. I should say we're not the only ones who have been involved in this program. There are other projects involving people like British Ceramics, Mineral Products Association, Glass Futures, all working on the same sorts of things. But the first one the first set of projects that we were involved with, we were working with Pilkington on hydrogen into their glass furnace, on Unilever with their boilers at their Port Sunlight facility, and with SR, which is a feed study into a new hydrogen-fueled CHP system. So talking in detail about Pilkington, so Pilkington's their Greengate furnace in St. Helens uses around 50 megawatts of natural gas. It's fired alternately from each side of the furnace. The exhaust gases go and heat up regenerators, and then when the direction of firing is reversed, the combustion air goes through those regenerators, recovering the heat, allowing them to achieve really high operational temperatures. Then they have the heat from the flame going into the raw materials and going into the wider furnace structure. So they had some specific concerns around that heat transfer. Is that going to work as well if we're using hydrogen? And there was a lot of really impressive modeling done by their team looking into that issue. Questions around NOx production, are we going to see a large increase? And again, modeling suggested, a new model developed by Pilkington suggested that wouldn't be an option. Sorry, wouldn't be an issue. They're also concerned about refractory impacts. So is it going to affect our existing furnace structure? So having done the modeling and having drawn some preliminary conclusions, we then went and converted one of their ports to hydrogen and fired it at 100% hydrogen. So on the top right there, you've got the port firing on natural gas, and you can see a clear flame. Then on the bottom right, you've got the hydrogen flame, which is much more difficult to see. But the results of this were really encouraging. We saw really good agreement between the luminosity modeling that had been done and the results. We saw that the glass and the raw materials were being effectively melted. We saw that the NOx emissions were in really good agreement with the model that Pilkington's had developed. So we're seeing kind of a 20 to 30% increase, which is well within the capabilities of their existing equipment, and they found that the atmosphere within the furnace was within their operating experience, so there was no major concern about refractory, which all led to the conclusion that once hydrogen's available, Pilkington's were ready to use it. And that wasn't just a kind of on paper, you know, nice line in a report. It's Pilkington are actually taking forward a HAR2 project to start putting hydrogen into the furnace. As we demonstrated. So the next one we did was at Unilever. So this was a two-stage program to use hydrogen in their boilers at Port Sunlight. So the first thing we did was we demonstrated at an off-site facility, demonstrating a small-scale representative burner on 100% hydrogen. And we showed that we could achieve NOx that was well below regulatory limits, and that we were operating at a comparable net efficiency to natural gas. Once we'd done that and shown that we could reliably raise steam, Unilever allowed us to go and convert one of their boilers. So we put in a new dual-fuel natural gas hydrogen burner, so that's the security of supply piece. The burner was switched seamlessly between the two fuels. We did that within one of the existing package boilers at Unilever's facility. And then we used 100% hydrogen to meet the site steam load over a period of 4 weeks. One of the reasons we were particularly interested in Unilever's site is they have packaged boilers which are pretty pretty ubiquitous design across the UK. So we reckon you can access around 5 million tonnes of carbon savings and were you to convert them all to hydrogen. So we've followed that with a second industrial fuel switching program with the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, so the successor to Bayes. And the two main projects that we've done under this have been with Kellanova, so previously Kellogg's, and Novelis, which is an aluminium recycler in Warrington. So the Kellanova work, they have two plants in the region, so in the northwest and in North Wales, and they produce all of the standard Kellogg's products that we're familiar with. They use natural gas in boilers, which we'd already demonstrated at Unilever, so there was no need to do that again, but also in their toasting and drying processes. Like everyone else, Kellanova has announced targets on emissions reductions and are looking for ways to meet those. So we planned a demonstration at Kellogg's, pilot scale operation in their, what they call their center of excellence, so their R&D center. So we're planning to do hydrogen fuel production of cornflakes, Rice Krispies, Special K and bran flakes. Having made the products, we'd subject them to the standard sampling and testing procedures that Kellanova do for all their food, including direct comparison against natural gas produced food. And the oven that they have in there is a full production oven that runs at low throughput, so it's representative of their processes worldwide. So we, for that trial, as with all of them, we've had hydrogen delivered to site by tube trailer by BOC, and then had the pressure let down and piped to the points of use. We changed the burners in the oven to fully flexible dual fuel burners again to enable seamless switching between natural gas and hydrogen. Most of the challenges that we encountered on the project were associated with the temporary hydrogen supply. So it's things about managing hazardous areas around the reception compound, and integrating systems like lightning protection with the existing site. We had some issues with a pressure regulator failing, taking down from tube trailer pressure to site pressure. But none of those issues really have anything to do with hydrogen suitability as a fuel long term. We wouldn't use tube trailer delivery. I think the main one that was relevant to long-term use was just around the Kellanova site team, who understandably weren't very familiar with hydrogen, but they were responsible for the safety of the installation. So we had to find a design approval process that allowed them to have the oversight and confidence that they needed to approve the design. And important in that was use of third-party expertise. So we progressed to actual use of hydrogen. It took quite a lot of people to run a hydrogen trial. Most of the ones in here are from Kellanova. There are a few from Otto Simon, who did most of the engineering, and project managers as well. So that was back in September. We're in the process of analyzing our results. But so far, we've had the product quality results back, and the conclusion has been that appearance, flavor, aroma, there's been no material impact on food quality from the switch to hydrogen. So the Rice Krispies on the left were made using natural gas, the ones on the right were made using hydrogen. No material difference. I tried some of the cornflakes, they tasted like cornflakes. And we were able to operate in compliance with existing environmental permit. So that's been a really successful trial. I'd say we're still ongoing with some of our analysis around the efficiency and the emissions, but we'll report those in due course. And then the final trial that we've got going on at the moment is with Novelis at their Latchford Locks Works in Warrington. So they've got capacity to recycle 195,000 tonnes of used beverage cans and automotive scrap annually. They're in the process of expanding that capacity, and they use natural gas in their melting furnaces. Like Kellanova, they've got carbon reduction targets So we've designed a test program at Novellis, which should be commencing on Monday. So we're quite excited, a little bit nervous. So that's to convert one of their melters to hydrogen. So we'll work our way up from 0% hydrogen up to 100% over the course of about a week. And we'll be doing that. It's a batch process melting aluminium, so we'll be melting whole batches with hydrogen and monitoring the efficiency, monitoring the dross production, and comparing that to operation on natural gas. We'll be sampling the product, sampling the refractory, and just making sure we've understood all of the implications of the switch. But the reason we chose Melter 3 is that it's representative of their furnaces worldwide, so we can roll this out more widely. On design installation, again, delivery by tube trailer to a temporary reception and pressure letdown compound. We've upgraded some of the refractory in the furnace, and we've upgraded the burners as well to again, dual-fuel natural gas and hydrogen burners. These ones are blend-capable as well. So the top picture is, I think, the cleanest aluminium furnace you'll ever see, because that one hasn't been used yet. And then the bottom, we've got it melting aluminium using natural gas. And here it is from the outside. I think conclusions from our IFS work, I think we've shown across a number of sites that safe hydrogen use can be accomplished using existing engineering design practices and standards. We've shown that hydrogen is a suitable replacement for natural gas in all of the applications that we've investigated to date. A lot of the learning is transferable between industries, but sites will need to do their own, or will want to do their own assessments. Found that where you've got resource-constrained site teams who aren't familiar with hydrogen, there is external expertise available to help get them across the line. The fundamental aim of the IFS program was to give sites confidence to make the switch to hydrogen, and it's done that. I think the question now is what next? And historically, funding streams like the Industrial Energy Transformation Fund have been really important in providing capital support for conversion. So we're hopeful that there will be future funding available from there. But for us, we're really keen to keep talking to users, help out with any feasibility questions and access to funding. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And as I mentioned earlier, if you can keep any questions you have in mind to the panel session later. I'd now like to introduce Roy Calder, Industry Principal, New Energies for Aviva.
Right, thanks very much. I actually thought I was at the end, so this came as a bit of a surprise. Anyway, my name's Roy Calder. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing to deliver the projects that you guys are all talking about. And ladies, sorry. So Aviva, we are part of the Schneider Electric Group. We are an industrial software company. We're almost 60 years old. Okay, we started off in California, Simulation Sciences, and we started off in Cambridge as the CAD Center, the first computer software to build chemical and process plants. Today, we're at the forefront of cloud and AI development, and it's all about data, whether it's engineering data, operational data, and I'm going to show you how it all comes together. But first, let's have a little look at what we're talking about. Now, I'm not going to talk to this slide because it's been talked about already. What we're seeing today is a hesitancy in a lot of these projects to move forward, either because of regulation, lack of infrastructure, or economics. And when it comes to economics, software can come to the fore to help drive the cost, the capital cost down, and then when you get to the operational side, start to drive the operational cost down. Don't take my words for it, I'll prove it now. So when we look at the industry today, We've got four R's: reduce, replace, recycle, and remove. So it's about reducing your energy consumption. It's about replacing one fuel for hydrogen or what have you, recycling a lot of waste. We've heard that this morning. And then removing through carbon capture, which is a key part of the HyNet project. Now, when you actually start to look at that in detail, you actually start to see that there are a number of steps you can take, whether it's from process efficiency, transport decarbonisation, which I think they're talking about next door, by the way, going to process electrification, if there was any electricity free in this country, which there doesn't seem to be for some reason, about the recycling through circular economy, and about taking carbon out of the equation. Now, when you look at all these together, you actually start to see a kind of commonality that Aviva can address. It's about looking at your strategic objectives. It's about establishing your foundational systems and getting right through that integrating of new technologies. And the session before lunch was a real eye-opener because there were some really interesting new technologies there. It's about bringing carbon capture into the fold. But more importantly, it's about how you manage these operations across an entire value chain. Because today, it's not about you alone. It's about who you're buying your renewable electricity from, who you're selling your products to, and how you manage that process. So at Aviva, when we come at this, we actually start to look at a life cycle approach, starting off with conceptual design, going through the detailed design into your FEED, into your construction operations, and starting the whole cycle again. Because we're chemical engineers, we're mechanical engineers, we're electrical engineers. We don't always get it right first time. We've also got to come back and have a second bite at the cherry. So in Aviva, we actually cover that entire portfolio. And we do it through a number of different processes here, from simulation through engineering, through the operational side, etc. Now, I realize that there are chemical engineers in the room here today, so I know that you don't like symbols, so I've actually put it up in words as well. So that's where we are. Now, what we have been looking at and what we're getting the feedback from customers is, how do we manage this levelized cost of hydrogen? So this is what a lot of the companies that we're seeing in Australia, on the east coast of Canada, I always get that one mixed up, they're all talking about contracts that are based on a levelized cost of hydrogen that is either being used over the fence or it's being used directly to be converted into ammonia and shipped overseas. So you've got to look at the economic feasibility, optimizing your design, and aligning with policy. And policies are very flexible across the world in terms of understanding what is going to change. We see changes in government bringing policy changes left, right, and center. And at the end of the day, everything has to be sustainable. So if we look at this in terms of the CapEx side, optimize your design process. Make sure that your project management gets the material right on time and keeps your construction costs under control. A digital twin allows you to build all that together and fits into the supply chain that you're delivering on. And at the end of the day, my favorite one, because I'm an old project manager, risk management. How do I minimize my project risk? But there's a flip side. You've also got to look at the OPEX. When you look at the OPEX, it's about how you improve your efficiency. And that comes about having predictive maintenance models. Energy management is critical here. And this is where we work with other parts of the Schneider Electric Group to bring that energy management to the forefront. And then obviously, visibility. Whether it's visibility from your operation or across the value chain, that's key for a lot of people. A lot of times when we talk about these sort of efficiencies, we forget people. People are fundamental to any process plant, and I am really passionate about bringing workforce efficiency to the fore here. and I'll talk a little bit about that later on. So how does this actually look? Well, you bring digital twins together. You actually use the engineering data and the operational data with an analytical set of tools in the middle, and one of those analytical tools is process simulation. And that entire environment there allows you to manage in real time and in predictive time how your levelized cost of hydrogen is going to be today, tomorrow, I would say the next week, but I don't believe the British weather forecast for the first moment, so I won't rely on that. So on the engineering side, we actually model the entire value chain. Now, I'm using the green hydrogen example here, but we can do it for SMRs, ATRs, and if one of the gentlemen from this morning wants to throw it at me, I'll do it for their process as well. Once you've modeled that entire chain, you can actually start to look at lifetime, life cycle cost analysis. And that allows you to minimize that CapEx side of the cost things. And that would include simulating the electrical side to reduce the electrical footprint as well in terms of inverters, transformers, etc. Moving on to the operational side, we're using the simulation as the KPI generator. We're using it to predict how things work. But that is only part of the story, because at the end of the day, what you need to do as well is make sure that everything in that value chain that you have control of, whether it's your inverters, whether it's your electrolyzers or compressors, is working optimally. So you bring in the design material from design specifications from the OEM suppliers, and you actually build a real model. And that means that at the end of the day, you've got everything there that you need to manage your levelized cost of hydrogen. Seen this picture before. That whole value chain is critical. Every phase of that value chain is critical in how you're going to manage that levelized cost of hydrogen. And of course, being a chemical engineer, you wanted to look a little bit more like a flowchart. So when you look at that, there's data in every direction. You need, as an operating company or as a value part of a value chain, to understand how to manage that data. And Aviva's approach is to use a thing called Connect. It's a cloud system that brings data together, allows analysis, visualization, and delivery of information across that value chain. It's a powerful, powerful tool. And it is, funnily, I always, when this was first mooted, I thought, well, people aren't going to want to share their data because that's part of their IP. All of a sudden, people are saying, well, if I give you that data and you give me your data, then I can give that person that data and he can do something better and it will reduce my costs. So very simply, when you actually start to bring this together, that's your process layer. Then you've got your data layer. That data layer is connected by Connect. It's then analyzed, and then it is actually actioned. You bring the action together, and you visualize it, and you visualize it across that entire value chain. Now, interestingly, this is the bit I love. That brings people back into the equation. And ladies and gentlemen, that is how you in a value chain deliver Industry 5.0. So, some case studies. I'm not going to deal with these in too much detail. ThyssenKrupp, engineering powerhouse in this area, they're using our software across the board, starting off with simulation and the engineering tools. The OEM market, Topsoe. Topsoe have modeled their SOEC electrolyzer in our software. They use it for all the process designs that are going out there. And if we get X energy moving ahead, that will be what will drive hydrogen off the SMR and PBR markets. Closer to home, our good friends Protium, down in London and in Wales, because this site is in Wales. They're actually using the simulation and the rest of the data management software to monitor and control their existing plant and design their next generation plants as well. I wouldn't be a chemical engineer if I didn't have a graph or two, so here's a graph or two. When you actually start to put it all together, looking at the impact of simulation, engineering, maintenance, and enhanced operational efficiency, you can see that you're going to drive down your costs. But at the same time, you're driving down your time scales. Your time to market reduces as well. Now, that's in an ideal world, as long as you can get all your pieces of hardware to be delivered on time. That's another story. So, in conclusion, we've got an efficient design approach and execution approach that deliver cost-effective operations with energy management across the board. And as a project manager, you're mitigating your risk on a capital project. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
So we're very keen to present. So I won't stand in the way of Fiona. So can I introduce Fiona Langdy, Hydrogen Lead Energy Transition for the Carbon Trust?
Okay. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Great to be here, and I have to say the presentations from earlier on today have been really heartening to see what's been happening in the hydrogen sector. I've been working in hydrogen the last 14, 15 years in Scotland predominantly, and it's great to see that we're really starting to try and get together and accelerate the uptake of hydrogen technologies across the piece. Today I'm going to talk about a bit of background about the Carbon Trust itself. I think maybe as an organisation it's a bit too modest about what it's been doing for the last 20 years. And then to go into a couple of accelerators as ideas and models of what we've been doing. And then really, so food for thought of what this platform can actually do going forward. So the Carbon Trust is actually, I would say spin-off, but it was from the UK government. And it has been for the last 20 years the pioneers behind that climate change agenda. We work across five continents around the world. We have offices in Singapore, in South Africa, in Mexico, in Berlin, in Denmark, Holland, and in the UK. And it's all around driving this agenda to really take a global view on how we can really be the pioneers and actually have the most impact in driving that climate change agenda. We have over 400 experts and consultants with over 20 years' experience across these different tech areas. Our impact model is about looking after our clients and what they are trying to do to achieve within their businesses. We work across all different types of sectors. We work with policymakers around the world, the governments, the agencies, the funders, the investment banks, with charities, philanthropics, you name it, we work with all of them, because it's going to take that level of concerted effort if we are really, really serious about driving that climate change. I mean, as we were talking about this morning, 1.5 degrees C, and it's going in the wrong way. We've seriously got to do something as a concerted effort to actually get that down. We're very broad in terms of our approach to how we actually do this. So corporate sustainability, as I mentioned earlier on, working with corporates to look at their agenda about how they look at their own supply chains in actually decarbonisation. Green finance, we work with all the banks and international banks as well, and investment organisations as well. Cities and regions in the UK, we work with at least 70% of cities and regions, and that's very much around their sustainability agendas, local area energy plans, local heat and energy plans, transportation, the whole gamut. That is what we try to help them with. looking at future energy systems, supergrids, decarbonisation of grids, offshore wind, I'm going to talk about more, and that's one of our flagship accelerators, and then the net zero agenda, and that's around looking at coal retirement, minerals and mining, cooling, and that's all on an international scale. So working across the world on all these types of initiatives to really help to really drive that agenda forward. So we have a number of accelerator platforms. I know accelerators are used quite a lot, but this one's been around for a long time. This one I'm going to talk about now is our flagship accelerator. And this was started back in 2008, and it was backed by the UK government. And the principal idea behind this was to try and bring, decided that offshore wind was going to be very big in the UK, and it was about bringing all the wind developers and that supply chain together to overcome the serious barriers that would be really affecting the deployment of offshore wind. And that has grown exponentially over the years. And as you can see from here, we have so many different platforms that have been added to the offshore wind platform as time has gone on. In terms of its reach and actually the economic benefit to doing this, it has saved that particular industry something like right now £1.5 billion. So it has had major impact. It has really helped to drive the supply chain and the innovation in this country. And now from that, we are exporting that intelligence and expertise around the world. So as you can see, from the initial offshore wind accelerator, we have the floating wind accelerator, which is a subsidiary of that. Looking across offshore wind in terms of the consenting environment, the risk mitigation around that, integration, how are you going to get that energy back on shore? And then looking at the organisation's sustainability as well, their platform in terms of their decarbonisation footprint as well. In terms of what that actually looks like in a governance structure, Energy Trust is been very experienced in actually dealing with really large platforms and complexities of actually being able to manage these types of platforms. As you see, we have our steering committee, and then we have the technical working groups, and then they're broken down into very smaller subsidiary platforms in terms of what they're actually concentrating on. But not all the partners want to actually be involved in every single one of these particular initiatives. So we also have discretionary projects where a number of the supply chain will come together and they will literally just concentrate on one particular discretionary project that really suits what they're trying to achieve. And so it is a very flexible platform, but it's very much driven by the partners and we are just there to manage the process. So in terms of this global reach, say now we've exported this around the world, we're speaking to a lot of companies in Asia, in Africa, for instance, in terms of what we can actually do to support them in this drive to a clean offshore wind and economy. As you can see, there's probably most of the world-leading corporates there that have been involved, and we're very grateful to be part of it. So the one I really want to talk to you today about is the Clean Hydrogen Innovation Programme. Now, this programme is, again, it's actually funded or supported by DESNZ. So about 3 years ago, the Carbon Trust did an innovation needs assessment and interviewed something like 500 stakeholders across the whole hydrogen supply chain to find out where are the key barriers, how do you support developers to actually fundamentally understand what in the midstream area, what needs to happen for them to ensure that they can accelerate the uptake of green or green hydrogen, for instance. And when you look at our ambitious targets by 2030 of 10 gigawatts of clean hydrogen, and 6 predominantly going to come from green, we have to have some almighty concerted effort to actually achieve this. So we're coming from the side of where are these key barriers, what needs to happen, to really drive forward this sector. So this is what CHIP set out to deliver. And this is starting 2023, and it's a multi-year joint innovation programme, as I say, backed by DESNZ, who match fund everything that we do, and it is all around driving innovation. What is looking over the horizon, what do we need to do to ensure that we have a robust supply chain that can deliver these hydrogen projects going forward? We need to make sure that we have enough capacity to ensure that whatever we need to be doing, it is happening in this midstream. And addressing that uncertainty, I mean, being hydrogen for so long, if all the ducks aren't in a row and there's uncertainty, whether it's policy, whether it's funding, or the technology, it just makes everything start to really ground to a halt. So that is what the intention of this platform is to deliver. I'm very delighted to say that we have two of the wind developers, Scottish Power and SSE, who are two of the partners, and also Natural Gas Transmission, and then a smaller SME, Lividium, who produce graphene and hydrogen as a byproduct. That they've come together and are working in phase two of the projects that we've just completed. So they have chosen very specific projects that they want to do a deep dive into. And for us, and I lead on this particular program, for us, we manage that, all the ITTs bring in the contractors to deliver very specific projects on their behalf. We also have a steering advisory committee as well, providing advice, and that's a very flexible committee, and it can change depending on what the expertise is actually required. But it's all about doing the market studies, desk-based research, and to ensure that whatever we are doing on behalf of the partners is delivering what they want. It's all around that impact, and actually having the intelligence that we've gathered that can be used when they're trying to deliver their projects. So this is what the program actually looks like. So anything from clean hydrogen production, we'll look at from that all the way through midstream, and this is not exhaustive, I mean, we could put a lot more in there, depending on what partners actually want to do, through to offtake. So anything you see that's in blue, we already did that in phase two, so those projects have now come to an end, and we have now been scoping phase three. There is a desire in phase three that we can start to see a transition to demonstration projects. It could be around compressors or electrolyzers or whatever project partners want to do. But it is all about looking at all these different areas in the supply chain and identifying what they see as something that they need to de-risk as soon as possible, and they are the projects that they take forward. Once DESNZ are happy with that, then they will provide the match funding. So the more partners we have involved in this platform, the more money we can leverage from DESNZ around this whole innovation landscape to really drive forward this particular programme. I think you could say that it's pretty unique. I don't know any other organisation that has an accelerator programme like this. And I think one thing that I've learned in all these has been in hydrogen is that we really need to come together. And I know that we have all the UK clusters forming, and that's fantastic, but we do need to have a more joined up approach if we're going to start to think about where the next investments need to be. I took this from Coastal Hydrogen UK, just to look at what came out of their supply chain strategy, to look at these different technologies, to see what their perspective were on this. And I'm pleased to say what they have been saying, we have incorporated into our innovation needs assessment, and that is part of our platform. I won't read these out individually, but you can see from all the different perspectives of where this particular platform could really add some benefit. I think it's really important that we are bringing along supply chain with us. I think it's very easy to overlook that supply chain is absolutely vital. It'd be good for companies to understand what's coming through early enough, so we have the HAR1, the HAR2 results, that they know what's going to be coming through and where these projects are going to be delivered, so they have time to ramp up and be ready for it. Reducing risk, we all know that we have to reduce risk out of projects. We need that investment, we need that certainty. But also we have a chance to work with governments, particularly UK Gov, because they don't have all the answers. And when we're talking about where they're going to put their money in for the next bit of innovation, through this platform and platforms similar like offshore wind, we're able to work with the governments and the body to actually, for them to feel more comfortable about where they're actually going to be putting their funding through. Because at the end of the day, it's got to have the biggest impact. Otherwise, we end up with a scattergun approach and we could say it novel when we really need to be much more at a higher scale. So as I say, every CHIP member will put some funding in, and it's more for corporate than it is for an SME, for instance, because that would be fair for SMEs. But you're leveraging that funding, so business will match anything that goes into this into the contributions from the private sector. But having that amount of money can really, really drive the impact of what we're doing in the UK, but also what we can export internationally. Part of my work is looking at building hydro economies in low to middle income countries. Our supply chain is vital for that particular initiative. And you know, if you can see now how other companies could get involved, it would be fantastic to really get this platform growing, as it's taken a long time for the offshore wind program to grow. But we could really start here and really expedite this and accelerate what we're doing in hydrogen technologies. So if anyone wants to get in contact, please do. I'd love to hear from you. I'm happy to change the platform in any ways if it's not right. But yeah, I'd really love to hear from you. And thank you very much for listening.
I don't know, it must have been something to do with lunch. Everybody's really keen. But Maybe I'm getting a bit slower because I've been doing this all day, up and down. But thank you, Fiona. I'd now like to introduce Richard Griffiths, who's the project lead for the MOD Strategic Command. So over to you.
Good afternoon. And I'm Richard Griffiths, Programme Manager working within Strategic Command. And I'm going to talk to you about the renewable energy trials that we've been looking at. And different to the Royal Air Force, the Army, the Navy, what Strategic Command tries to do is influence those other areas and look at particular problems they have. Strategic Command has a responsibility for overseas bases in particular, so that is what we're trying to do with renewable energies. So why are we doing these trials? Although future energy discussions are complex for some military contexts, in reasonably domestic environments, such as Ascension Islands, Falkland Islands, and looking at past deployments to Africa, for instance, we can make huge headway in decarbonisation while significantly reducing both our direct fuel and operating costs, and also, and importantly, increasing our self-sufficiency. So ambitious and bold is our driver, and with our aim with the Falkland Islands is to replace that 1 million litres of diesel that we use every single month in the Falkland Islands. So that's what we're trying to do with hydrogen and a renewable energy solution. So we're trialling a renewable energy solution sized to the battlefield static power space using a system of systems approach where the off-shelf renewable energy technologies combine to give us a solution that is more than the sum of the parts. So by combining all of the renewables, wind, solar, battery, and importantly, hydrogen, we can deliver a robust and powerful solution to our energy needs now and for the future needs of the bases as well. So while military use of solar is being exploited, for example, the Army have tried a number of locations in the UK, Project Prometheus is what it's called, there's been no testing of mobile wind or combining all of these renewable solutions together in that systems of systems approach. So what we're looking to do is get the user benefits that come from manufacturing your fuel at point of use. Those benefits mean that we don't have supply chains to protect. We will also need new skills to learn to harness these technologies, but it also means we need less diesel logistics, less storage, less maintenance skills, for instance. So in the picture there, you can see in the middle, there's a fuel truck. We're going to need less of those. and also there's a shipping container. That's currently how some of the fuel gets down to the Falklands. So that's what we're trying to get after, is trying to reduce that. So besides the physical aspects of the trial, we're also looking at the digital operation of these solutions and using such technology, like developing a digital twin with Plymouth University to identify the best mix of the renewables for a specific deployment and power requirements. So using this approach, we can develop and tailor the equipment, for instance, test a requirement for no noise, lightweight operation, or high power. These are the areas we're keen to exploit in training our personnel in these future skills. So operational benefits to adopting tech like this are profound. It is, for us, an energy revolution. It is going to take time and commitment to develop from where we are at the moment to how we're going to operate them. It's going to be a change in how we work. For instance, where there's no fuel carrying asset required, no maintenance, no ship to charter, how do we then develop that for the future, these new renewable energies? So how are we going to do it? So we've developed a hydrogen roadmap explaining how we're going to introduce green hydrogen production and its supporting systems into the Falkland Islands from 2027, having trialled the systems in the UK. We're looking to build experience and confidence in the system reliability. The Falklands are 8,000 miles away. To get the service maintenance engineer out there, you're looking at 2 to 3 weeks. So we're looking at reliability particularly. So looking at our work to date, we have tested off-the-shelf solutions, if you look in phase one on the left-hand side of the slide, for mobile off-grid electricity production using hydrogen. And those systems ran 12 months continuously without fault and only the minimum amount of checks. We have also trialled hydrogen cars to give a carbon-free off-grid mobility solution. While the form and size of the equipment is not ideal, perhaps, but it sets the art of the possible with hydrogen fuel. So phase two this year, we're looking to fine-tune the solution, again using off-the-shelf solutions, hitting the aim of producing hydrogen fuel on-site and developing that renewable energy system of systems hydrogen ecosystem. And we're doing that on the most demanding MOD site that we've got in the UK. We're looking to test ourselves when it comes to the regulations. How do we get around them? So phase three, on the right-hand side of the slide, is really the deployment, using the skills and experience gained. The phase three aim is the exploitation, and we're looking to replace 10,000 litres of diesel that we use per month that we currently ship from the UK. That fuel is used to power 40 diesel vans in the Falklands, for instance. If we can change those to electric vans and have a system that uses these renewables, I've suddenly saved myself 10,000 litres per month that I currently ship to the Falklands. So the bold and ambitious roadmap approach to the renewables question gives a structured and stepped approach to energy innovation in the MOD to get to an agreed outcome that delivers. Finally, what about our NATO allies? We need to think how we're going to work collaboratively with those. So they are using hydrogen-based renewable systems, ecosystems at the moment. So for example, the French are about to start their second system. The first was in the Glorious Islands for about 15 people. The second system supports 500 people in French Guiana with a no diesel solution. And the Americans have a much bigger system supporting Pearl Harbor. So it can be done, and there are real benefits on it. So in conclusion, we have a bold aim. Never send diesel to the Falkland Islands again. It's a big ask. We have a roadmap on how we're starting that journey to achieve the aim in a quicker and more flexible solution than using infrastructure alone. You may have noticed it's all very mobile equipment, what we're looking at. Fixed infrastructure takes a long time. It will come. It will come down there, but what we need is something there now. And of course, the secondary benefit of that is if we deploy anywhere in the future, we've got a solution we can deploy quickly. We need to reduce our supply chains for many reasons. So while renewable energy has a quick return on investment, it is not always the cheapest up front. And this is where we're failing behind in the military. We need to have roadmaps like this to inform what we're doing, inform industry what we're trying to get after. And this, this whole thing that we're doing, renewable energies, is the biggest change in military affairs for a generation at least. Thank you.
Right. Does anybody have any questions? Oh, we have a question at the front.
Hello, I'm Jessie Bagley from the Tees Valley Combined Authority. I've got a question for Mike. You mentioned about the knocks on your Unilever project and the fact that they're below regulatory limits. Is there a concern that if everyone thinks like that, they're suddenly then going to all add together and we're going to have a big problem on our hands?
So when we did the Unilever trial, the regulatory limits that would apply to hydrogen hadn't yet been defined. So what we did was we aimed for the natural gas limits. Since we did that, the Environment Agency has produced guidance on hydrogen combustion in MCPD and IED installations, so boilers and power generation. And the guiding principle of that has been to make sure that when we're operating on hydrogen, the emissions are no higher than on natural gas. So when you're operating on hydrogen, you don't produce... So the emission limits are set on a volume, on a concentration basis in a volume of flue gas. When you use hydrogen, you produce less flue gas. So the concentration that you can tolerate increases for the same actual emission of hydrogen. So the Environment Agency have set the new rules on the basis of ensuring that in a switch to hydrogen, the mass of NOx emitted by any installation won't increase.
Okay, any other questions?
That's a question, I suppose, for the CAM Trust and probably for Progressive Energy as well. We're hearing about lots of research, innovation work that's going on in government bodies, kind of the gas networks, private companies, consultancies. And you mentioned about kind of collaborating and kind of coordinating. But with this whole volume of work and lots of different disparate kind of organisations coming from different aspects, what do you think is the kind of route and the mechanisms we can use to coordinate that work? So, other than obviously events like this, to ensure that everybody is aware and we don't have duplication or gaps.
No, I absolutely agree. I think we have to get away from novel. We have to get away from replicating what we've done before. So, when I was talking about the hydrogen clusters, for instance. I would love all the clusters to come together and have that conversation so each one knows what the other one is doing and how, rather than replicating it, what can we learn so different regions could take strength and lead on one particular initiative or two or three initiatives. So we're not going to keep repeating that, and the supply chain knows what's happening across the UK and knows where they can have a role to play. And I think about oil and gas companies transitioning to hydrogen, and SMEs coming through, setting up organisations. If they don't understand where the opportunities are, it makes it very hard. So hence why I'm talking about this clean hydrogen innovation platform, like we did for offshore wind, where you could bring everyone together to have that much more coordinated approach, where you can have governments there, you can have the policymakers, you can have investor days. We can then try and have a much more coordinated approach, is what the idea is about. Because we need it, otherwise we're just going to repeat what we've done in the past. And we end up sometimes actually funding initiatives that won't go further than a demonstrator, and we need to get away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that events like this are really helpful. I think one of the advantages with the government funding pots that we've drawn on is that when they when they make their assessment, they're often taking into account the suite of technologies that they're funding. So at that level, there's a decision around making sure that they're not just funding five people to go and do exactly the same things. And then with that money comes dissemination obligations, so that we, you know, make sure we get out there and tell people what we've done and share the knowledge.
I think also it's dispelling the myths around hydrogen and informing people as well. I think there's a lot of mixed messages about this whole decarbonised journey that we're on. And I understand why citizens would get really confused about what's right, what's wrong. So I think that's another piece, you know, like a platform that we have, that coordination, can really start to actually get those communications out there of why we're on this journey, the importance, and reminding people why we have to tackle climate change. I know that, you know, we spoke about this morning, you know, you can't blame people, you know, the price of energy and food and everything else, the whole clean net zero agenda sort of gets lost in it all, but we have to bring it back into focus again. And I think we can do that as a collective.
I have a question, actually related to that, and mainly for the whole panel, but mainly for Mick and Richard. How do we accelerate, kind of the adoption of hydrogen? We talked about all the fuel switching trials. That's obviously taken a lot of time. The work for the Falklands is testing, you know, all package systems and everything. How do we accelerate that? Is there a way to accelerate that and avoid kind of doing all this testing? Because at some point, you know, have we not done enough so that kind of off-takers are just happy to adopt the technology? Are there ways that we can accelerate that?
Yeah, I think, I don't keep blaming governments, so it's not about that, but you need to have that consistent policy. And we've gone back 10 years. We were surging forward and looking really good, and then suddenly this flip-flopping back and forth. It doesn't help anyone, doesn't help investors, it doesn't help SMEs, doesn't help corporate, it doesn't help anyone. And we need that consistency that, you know, we're standing firm, that hydrogen has a role for the future. And then that infrastructure is absolutely of paramount importance. And we need that funding to be coming through to support what we're trying to do as well. You'll see that, I remember years ago working with Scottish Power, for instance, for their Whiteley offshore wind farm. And that was for Glasgow City Council, so we had the vehicles, everything else. And they got stuck in planning permission. And everything just comes grinding and halt, and that's 5 years later, here we are, they got funding in Hull 1. That's not going to help the UK at all when, as you can see, Europe is flying ahead and we are falling further and further behind the curve. So we've got to have that consistent policy, investors feel confident that they can actually invest. Risk has to be taken out of these projects, and we have to get away from novel scale areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the industries that we've worked with, it's now a question of hydrogen availability. So anything that could be done to speed up the availability of hydrogen. So the ongoing hydrogen allocation rounds, it would be great to get a decision on those soon. I think the business models that are in place for CCS and for hydrogen production are really helpful. But the final piece in that jigsaw is transport and storage of hydrogen. So we need that business model soon, please.
I think there's a view that I have that is not British-centric, looking further afield. The projects that we see coming to fruition globally, like NUOM that was discussed this morning, have got dedicated offtakes for the hydrogen. Yeah. If you don't have that, the project's dead in the water. We've seen that in the US with Hystore, which was going to be part of a green steel plant. Yeah. Green steel plant fell away, the hydrogen project fell away. So we need to consider the entire value chain when we're looking at these projects. And I don't want to comment about the HAR1 projects and how long they've taken to get to commercial FID, but what's going to happen with the HAR2 projects if they follow the same path? You know, that scares the living daylights out of me. So we've got to think about that entire value chain when we put a hydrogen plan together.
Yeah. Richard, do you have?
From my experience, it's pr- projects which are out there which can influence what we are after, which is make your own fuel at the point of use. So just looking at what the Americans have done, what the French have done, you know, that, you know, it demonstrates firstly that it can work. Here's the numbers, this is how it works, for instance. And then we use that as inspiration to push forwards with it. Because I think, you know, it's certainly in my business, we're really energy conservative. So any change is just not there. You know, the infrastructure is expensive. So how can we think about, you know, opportunities? You know, what's the quick wins? You know, the first step on that staircase, so to speak, of introducing, you know, hydrogen right across the business.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, off-takers, they want, you know, they're very conservative. They want to be assured that this is going to work. So, you know, I think certainly from my point of view, another thing that would kind of maybe unlock and accelerate the process is sharing of information. So all of the good test work that Mick, you talked about in terms of the fuel switching with Unilever and Kellogg's and the likes, if they were able to share that with the industry as a whole and reassure other companies that are at the start of that journey and looking to switch, then they might avoid going through all of that testing, you know, and actually adopt it much quicker. So, yeah. Okay. Any questions from the audience? Okay. Tough gig this afternoon. I've got a question with regards to for yourself, Rory, about Roy. Sorry. What? Hang on a second. Okay. You talked about, you know, kind of efficiencies in the whole process from kind of design all the way through to kind of build and operation. You know, kind of where do you see, you know, inefficiencies coming in? Do you think, you know, there are some human factors to consider here? Because there are different stakeholders potentially who might, you know, for example, somebody might, a different kind of company might do the pre-feed to the EPC, you know, and all of those are going to introduce an inefficiency, yeah, in the process.
So I always find it quite funny when I think about inefficiencies. It comes down to documentation, and I'll come back to that. And I remember my first visit to Sharjah to Petrofac, and I looked at their cricket fixtures, and there were 8 document teams, document transmission teams. So that means they had 88 people managing documents. Now, that's not efficient. So the approach that we're taking, and we utilize the power of the cloud and work tasks and things like that, it's all about making the data the single source of truth and allowing people to access the data that they need, and then that filters through the entire process. So it takes people out of the equation while empowering them at the same time, because you're not having to go through the various stages of passing drawing one to Fred and to Tom. Fred makes one set of changes, Tom makes another set of changes, comes back to you, and you've got 4 sets of changes to make at the end of the day. That is definitely inefficient. The companies today, the Fluors, the Bechtels, the McDermotts, etc., are learning that quickly. They're moving in that direction. What's not happening is the client community going with them. Because at the end of the day, if you're investing in a plant, you, as the plant owner and the person who put the money up, you should own that data. Don't wait till it's finished. You own it from the outset, and then you're part of that equation, and that improves the efficiency again, because it allows you to bring different contractors in on the same data. And that's, we're proving that time and time again. That's a fundamental way that Shell are reducing their project approach and improving efficiency. And unfortunately, that hasn't carried over onto Hydrogen One in Rotterdam, but that's another story.
Any questions? Okay, I'll keep going. With regards to the Clean Hydrogen Innovation Program. Did I hear correct, Fiona? Is there an opportunity for people to join?
Yeah.
And if so, how would they go about that?
Get in contact with me would be fantastic. It's simple as that. Yeah. Absolutely. As I was saying, you know, at the moment it's really in its infancy, and we want to obviously bring in more partners, particularly the developers, but also the supply chain as well. And it's not set in stone what we're doing right now. We can develop that program. If we want to look at certification, and we were talking about this earlier on, and safety, we can do all that. It's whatever the partners want to do. And if there's some aspects that not all the partners want to do, we can do these discretionary projects as well. There is this desire from DESNZ, and I can see why, is that we start to transition into demonstration projects, so proper research, small demonstrations, particularly around different aspects of the supply chain where we know there are, from our research, that we know there are issues, and work with the industry to resolve those issues. I'd be delighted to speak to anyone.
But the focus is very much on the midstream. You're not kind of look downstream to application of hydrogen in industry examples like
presented. Yeah, we can do from the offtake point of view. But it was really supporting the producers to remove the barriers midstream for them to accelerate offtake. But we can identify those opportunities as well during that process. And also be able to signpost to the supply chain of where these opportunities are when we talk about the UK clusters, you know, so we can really start to ensure that we are reindustrializing our own supply chain in the UK, not just importing when we've got those companies already in this country.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, we have a question at the front.
Thank you. Hi, Ross Howells from Burgess Salmon. Question for Richard, actually. It was Richard, wasn't it? Yeah. I can't imagine it being very easy to affect change in an organisation like the MOD, especially sort of renewable energy changes. You touched on it, but I thought it'd be worthwhile asking again. What makes your job a lot easier in terms of affecting that change and getting renewable energy on board in the MOD? And I guess the flip side of that is, what are the barriers that you're seeing in your job to say, actually, I can't take this technology forward internally? Because I think there's a lot of people in the room that would find that insight interesting. Thanks.
Yeah, so the challenge, I come across it all the time. People are like, oh, we can't use that. Why use hydrogen? Let's just use diesel with batteries and wind turbines. And it's like, no, hang on, the point is we're trying to make our own fuel, so we're not reliant on the supply chain. But I'm having to make that conversation time and time again. It's almost like I've got one end of the socket, but there's no plug to put in, so to speak. So it's doing trials, you know, showing examples of where it does work and publicising that within our own organisation, and it's a constant. It's a constant battle, partly because you've got the stovepipes, for instance. Infrastructure is, you know, constrained, money constrained. But what we're trying to do is look at, you know, don't do the elephant, try and do a little bit of it. You know, show an example of where it does work. It's a no-brainer. It'll save you money. It'll pay for itself within 2 years. And that's exactly what the French have done in their overseas locations. You know, the start of year three, that energy is free, you know, whereas previously they were shipping diesel there. So it's using those sort of examples and going, why aren't we doing this? So those are the arguments I'm having to brief all the time. But it's, you know, brief the middle layers of our business and also the top layers, and it's just continually banging that drum and saying, this is what we need to be looking at. But what happens is, you know, when you do this, I start getting emails coming, oh, we're having a look at hydrogen, we're doing it. They're doing their own thing. And I'm like, oh, hang on, we need to know what you're doing. You know, so there's a real interest in terms of energy resilience on bases, for instance. You know, if the power goes down, what happens? We can't continue to do our job. So that's a real risk. So energy resilience that's not diesel is now being looked at. So, you know, it does come out, it does come, but what we've got to have, I think, firmly believe, we've got to have a roadmap, don't eat the elephant at once, and show the benefits as you go along. Thank you.
Just taking that point a bit further, is there a plan beyond, you know, looking beyond the Falklands, you know, to apply this hydrogen and renewables elsewhere?
Yes. Yeah, so the Falklands, what we're obviously looking at is never send diesel down there. We use a million and a half litres of diesel per month to generate electricity. It's absolutely barking mad. So this is what we're up against. You know, we're trying to prove this solution. And it's got to be a systems approach, because you know, there has been a project recently to reduce the amount of diesel used on Ascension Island. But they're looking at it and going, well, if we can reduce it by a bit, that's a good job. No, it's not a good job. So we're looking at the other locations and other areas influence, for instance. So there's a project called Maneuver Power. So that's very much you know, the mobile generators that we might use. There is a program coming up in the next couple of years to replace all of it. And at the moment, what they're doing is diesel generators and batteries and maybe a little bit of solar. So what we're trying to do is influence that. So some of the work that we're doing already is starting to influence that. So they're starting to say, in particular the Army, is starting to say, actually, maybe this hydrogen thing will work in some circumstances. So we're starting to do that, you know, to peel back the issues, undercover what are the issues that we've got, and make sure that we can work with this fuel.
Any other questions?
Hi. I was wondering, should, through things like the CHIP programme, through domestic policy, through subsidy, should we be prioritising investment into sort of domestic manufacturing capability so that the supply chain, you know, as we develop the HyNet project, East Coast Cluster, that learning is captured and retained within the UK, that you know, we're investing billions into renewable energy, that the investment is going into UK businesses, is then recycled, and it's not being sent to other European countries or something, which will, you know, add value in those countries and also improve the security supply chain for, say, Strategic Command.
I think it's vital that we look after our supply chain. I think it's really sad when you hear about companies who are trying to grow and make the right investment choices, when to grow, and then they go through the next Series B funding round and they can't get the finance. It just creates such uncertainty when we know we've got the expertise. And through a lot of the research we've done and stakeholder engagement, some of the organisations we've spoken to have said, we're not really worried about the UK supply chain because we just import it. And we can't have that. You know, it is, not to get, you know, too parochial, but it is about what we have here. You know, develop the skills, and we've got the expertise, you know, from the oil and gas industry that we could be transitioning and using. It's around, you know, growing our own skill workforce and our own supply chain in this country. It's really, really important. And some great demos you have that you've been working on, they're fantastic projects. We can learn from them and just keep growing, not this stop-start approach and that uncertainty all the time. Yeah, really important.
I was just going to add to that. Yes, we have the same issues. We want to share data, particularly with NATO partners. So, for instance, what the Americans and the French are doing. You know, and things that are important to us are less important in the commercial world. So reliability is really important. So we want the gold-plated solution. It's not going to fail, as opposed to getting the service engineer in 24 hours notice. So what is the best solution? And interoperability between those forces is those are the sort of things we're looking to share data on, and we are doing.
Okay, any more? For any more? Okay, I think I've exhausted my own questions. So, with that in mind, I'm going to give you all an extra 5 minutes for your coffee break. So. Thank you very much, everybody, for your attention. Please thank the panelists for their contributions.